Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and we welcome today's meeting at the Commonwealth Club of California, brought to you from the club's offices overlooking beautiful San Francisco's financial district. I am Gene Herzon, past president of the club, and your chair today. We also welcome the listeners of radio station WGUC-FM in Cincinnati, one of the more 225 stations nationwide carrying America's longest-running radio program. We invite all our listeners here and on radio to join us on the Internet at our site at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now, here to introduce tonight's special guest is Ed Stolman, a member of the Commonwealth Club and a friend of the speaker. Ed is a Glen Ellen resident who came from afar. We appreciate his support and interest in the club.
Thank you, Gene. I first met Bob Butler 3 years ago at a health spa in Arizona. Bob was there to give a lecture on aging, and my wife Carolyn and I were there to try to hold back the aging process by exercise, proper eating, and so forth. The first day we were there, I went for the early morning walk, and I saw another silver-haired guy and thought he'd be a likely candidate to walk with. Little did I know that he was in great shape and a hard person to keep up with. I found him interesting, so much so that I pushed myself just to keep up with him to be able to continue a conversation with him. We walked together each day, and soon I felt that we were developing a pretty darn nice relationship. The following year, we met again, and our friendship grew, and in fact, our wives became friends. We have since visited with them in New York and are now looking forward to being with them again this coming January. As I got to know Bob, I learned and read about his illustrious career, and I'd like to share a little about him. Bob Butler is a physician, gerontologist, psychiatrist, public servant, and a Pulitzer Prize-winning author for his book, Why Survive Being Old in America. He is perhaps best known for his advocacy of the medical and social needs and rights of the elderly. In 1982, he founded the Department of Geriatrics and Adult Development at the Mount Sinai Medical Center, the first department of geriatrics in the United States Medical School, and has served as chairman and Brookdale professor since 1995. In 1995, he became president and CEO of the International Longevity Center, a position that he holds today. In 1973, he became the founding director of the National Institute on Aging of the National Institute of Health, where he remained until 1982. His earlier research helped establish the fact that senility was not inevitable with aging, but is instead a consequence of disease. At the National Institute of Aging, he identified Alzheimer's disease as a national research priority. In addition, Dr. Butler helped found the Alzheimer's Disease Association, the American Association of Geriatric Psychiatry, the American Federation for Aging Research, and the Alliance for Aging Research. I can go on and on about his publications and books he has written, including a book he co-authored called Love and Sex After 60, which is recommended reading for a lot of us in this room. I could also read a very long list of his research and the organizations that he is associated with, but the list is so long that I would take up all the time allotted to him. I might say, however, that Dr. Butler worked closely with John Glenn to help make his dream of going into space again a reality because of the knowledge that would help all of us on the aging process and the effects thereof. It is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Robert Butler, a truly wonderful man, and I am proud to be his walking buddy.
Thank you very much, Ed, for that very, very generous introduction. It's a great pleasure to be in San Francisco. I had a marvelous time here many, many years ago as a resident at the great University of California Medical Center before I was selected to go to the National Institutes of Health as a young researcher in 1955. So I've been in this wonderful field for 45 years, and I speak tonight about the wonderful world of longevity, celebration or calamity. The world has experienced three waves of longevity. Between 2.5 million years ago and 100,000 years ago, fossil evidence suggests a doubling of the size of the cranium and perhaps intelligence. There is also evidence of a doubling of the length of life as hominids evolved to Homo sapiens. 12,000 years ago, during the Neolithic period, animal husbandry and agriculture became established and brought a greater abundance of food. Humanity no longer had to survive as hunters-gatherers. At the same time, there came a greater density of human settlements. There was closer contact with animals and insect vectors, and therefore with diseases. Beginning in the 17th century, the Industrial Revolution initiated major increases in longevity. For example, in the United States in 1776, the average life expectancy was 35. The average age of our founding fathers was 40. Of course, there was that wonderful outlier, Benjamin Franklin, who did so much to solve some of the problems in the Constitutional Convention at the age of 82. In 1900, the average life expectancy was 47. Today, it is 76.5 years. In short, we have gained 40 years of additional life since the American Revolution and 30 years of additional life since the beginning of the century. The latter 30 years exceeds what had been gained during the preceding 5,000 years of human history from the Bronze Age. In the 21st century, we're likely to experience a fourth wave of longevity following effective biomedical research, one disease at a time. But there are also possibilities for retarding the processes of aging. Somewhat less likely might be the discovery of genes that might actually affect the inherent length of life. Regarding longevity, we ain't seen nothing yet. Today we have 70,000 centenarians. By 2050, we will be approaching 900,000 centenarians by current trends without any new research. We're not only living longer, but better. There has been a 60% drop in deaths from heart disease and stroke since 1950, as well as significant decreases in disability rates. Oliver Wendell Holmes, physician and the autocrat of the breakfast table, alluded in the Deacon's masterpiece, The One Hoss Shay, to what James Fries at Stanford was to call the compression of morbidity. Between 1982 and 1994, it was calculated that there were more than 1 million fewer disabled people than would have been expected. What an impact further declines in disability rates will have upon Medicare costs, to say nothing of quality of life. Late life itself has been redefined from a portrait of passivity, senility, and sexlessness to one of activity, vigor, and intellectual robustness. Studies conducted at the National Institutes of Health and at Duke University in the 1950s resulted in the realization that many of the stereotypes and ideas attributed to aging were, in fact, actually a consequence of disease, social adversity, and even personality. These studies opened the possibilities of the mutability of aging, the capacity to actually change, and began to elucidate underlying mechanisms of aging, such as the work of Leonard Hayflick, who found the limited number of cells that would be able to replicate before death. Now, I can think of three terrific illustrations of how late life has been redefined. One is a volunteer in our studies at the National Institutes of Health, Morris Rocklin. I can mention his name because he was a volunteer, not a patient. I saw him first when he was 94 years of age, and he died at 102. I last saw him when he was 101 years old. He complained bitterly about his physician, to whom he had gone to report considerable pain in his right knee. His doctor patronizingly said, as doctors do today, "Morris, what do you expect at your age?" But Morris answered, "Now look here. My left knee is also 101. How come it doesn't hurt?" Then there's Jeanne Calment, the French woman who lived to be 122. At the party celebrating her 120th birthday, a French journalist said hesitantly, "Well, I guess I'll see you next year. To which she replied in a flash, I don't see why not. You look to be in pretty good health to me. And then, of course, there's John Glenn, terrific person, good friend, going on his remarkable voyage into outer space at 78 and returning to Earth without any of the physical problems some expected him to have as a result of the journey. I don't think children are ever going to look at their grandparents in quite the same way again. By the way, the results of the work that was conducted in outer space will be reported January 27th. Many terms have been applied to the ongoing redefinition of late life. Successful aging is one that Dr. John Rowe and I have used. Productive aging is a term I introduced in 1983 to convey the valuable contributions, unpaid as well as paid, that older people make to their family, community, and national life. The Foundation of the World has calculated that billions of dollars of equivalent contributions through volunteering come from older people. Healthy aging, optimal aging, vital aging are other terms that are being employed. Active aging has been adopted by the World Health Organization, and it was used in the Denver G8 communique a few years ago, at which time the ministers meeting and leaders meeting in the world concluded that aging really was a profound economic, political, and policy issue. Indeed, the impact of longevity and population aging is pervasive. It affects the economy, work patterns, family life, health care, living arrangements, lifestyles, socioeconomic roles, educational systems, government itself, and much, much more. It is necessary to prepare individuals and society for population aging and longevity, and to do so in positive and productive ways. Three big tasks are before us: to improve and maintain the expectation of a continuing active and healthy life into great old age, to extend the productive work life, and of course to contribute to the adaptation of the changing American family. We may soon have 4- and 5- generation families as the norm. Can you imagine Thanksgiving and it's time to go to grandmother's house? We're going to have to rent a community center. In what context is this revolution in longevity occurring? On the positive side, we are going through an information explosion. I hardly need say more about that, Silicon Valley being nearby. And we are seeing the rise of non-governmental organizations, the civil society, which, for example, has been credited with bringing down apartheid in South Africa. But there has also been a rising inequality of longevity, health, wealth, and education, and growing concentrations of power around the world. African-American men in Baltimore, for example, do not live as long as Bangladeshi men. The average life expectancy of the developing world approximates between 62 and 65 years of age, 10 to 12 years less than the industrialized world. And perhaps 20% of third world lives are lost in disease and disability. Although in this global economy, it is in the best interest of us, of the developed world, to have healthy and productive consumers in the developing world. Let us maintain some perspective. We should be concerned about Social Security, trust funds, and Medicare costs, but we must look beyond immediate headlines to the worlds of work and health. Overall, there is bipartisan agreement about the need to preserve the essentials of Social Security and Medicare. So let's look more broadly at implications of the great social upheaval likely to follow this continuing revolution of longevity. It is instructive to think back to 1899, when the average life expectancy was 47, and the normal work week was 60 hours. My chief financial officer would be wearing a green eye shade, and doctors would be driving about in a horse and buggy. Now in 1999, the average life expectancy is 76.5. We have a 40-hour week with a minimum wage, Medicare, Social Security, air conditioning, air travel, computers, much more. What's 2099 going to bring? Conceivably, people will live 120 years. Having reached the maximum genetically determined lifespan as a result of biomedical and behavioral research. Perhaps people will work a 30-hour week until they are 90, with many choosing to work at home. A national youth community service will delay entry into the workforce. Everyone will go on sabbatical in order to upgrade skills. Already in Australia, they have extended service leave with opportunities for people to upgrade their skills. These are sabbaticals not just for academics, but for everyone. In Norway, there is consideration by the parliament that a Norwegian receive 1 year off every 10 years in order to rebuild their educational and technological skills. Here we are at the end of 1999, on the brink of the new millennium, and we still must conclude that individuals and society are not yet prepared for this unprecedented population aging and longevity. We haven't yet worked out multiple careers and how we're going to extend the work life. We have yet to establish affordable community-based long-term care. Germany and Japan are doing much better in this regard. Our country does not have geriatric specialization. Only 3 of our 125 medical schools have departments of geriatrics, compared to Great Britain, where every medical school has a department of geriatrics. We have a long way to go to develop pharmaceuticals that give us magic bullets that cure the disease without causing so many untoward side effects. Living arrangements and housing have yet to fully meet the requirements of a long-living society for services, safety, and security. Overall, our citizenry is illiterate when it comes to matters of financial planning. Our children are not educated to understand savings and investments. We need new financial instruments, as well as the safety net of Social Security. Transportation has a long way to go. Imagine trying to get in and out of a taxi cab these days if you have even a touch of arthritis. Our technology has yet to become truly elder-friendly, and our information sources elder-friendly and elder-ready. Our leisure and travel leave much to be desired. All too often, people go overseas on the great European tour. They arrive at Paris in the morning. Hotel beds are not available. They are carted off to the Eiffel Tower, exhausted. Inadequate attention is given to jet lag, which becomes all the more an issue as we grow older. Our advertising age industry, Madison Avenue, still hasn't caught up with the fact that the 50-plus group is where the money is, and they continue to devote their energy to the 18 to 49 age group. And our packaged food and restaurants are not sensitive to health promotion and the special nutritional needs of various segments of our population. At the same time, the field of medicine is going through dramatic changes and is likely to extend longevity still further. Regenerative medicine will restore vision to those with macular degeneration. It will cure diabetes by replacing beta cells in the pancreas, and Parkinson's disease by being able to create dopamine-bearing cells in the brain. Geriatric medicine will also necessarily become a major field in the next century. Who is responsible for our old age? The family, of course, and government, and civil society, and business all share responsibility. For example, the National Institute on Aging has helped us confront Alzheimer's disease. Nobody had ever heard of it before 1975, as well as other debilitating conditions of old age. And the Administration on Aging has provided an array of social and nutritional services. The private sector, too, has fostered much in the way of care management in the provision of services for older people. But finally, it is the individual who must prepare for longevity. People need to plan for aging in a variety of ways. They need financial planning, intellectual stimulation, and a sense of purpose. Meaningful social interactions are especially important. One reason women outlive men by 7 years is that women tend to have a more secure and intimate social support system than do men. Social interaction also contributes to maintenance of intellectual function. People of all ages need to establish healthy eating habits. It is difficult to change ingrained patterns. However, a reasonable diet and regular activity are critical for healthy aging. In our country, over 50% of people are overweight, and a third are obese, and yet we are still eating too much sugar and fat. People need to replace the national fast food diet with a low-fat, complex carbohydrate, fiber diet with fruits and vegetables. Our aerobic activity level must be tremendously increased, along with muscle resistance training, coordination, and muscle. It is muscle and balance that protect us against fractures. It's amazing to know that once a hip fracture has occurred, 40% of those affected are gone by the end of the year. In addition to anti-gravity exercises, our bodies need calcium. We're supposed to eat our 5 to 7 fruits and vegetables daily, but we need to be realistic and take vitamins to supplement what our diets lack. Studies undertaken by the National Institute on Aging on the possible benefits of vitamin E in preventing Alzheimer's disease use 800 international units. And while we must avoid excessive sun exposure, we must have enough of it to maintain our vitamin D levels, which are created in our skin, and to maintain an appropriate wake-sleep cycle. Finally, at minimum, older persons need a baby aspirin every day as a preventative against stroke. Happily, our prescription for longevity also includes robust exercise for the brain. The French call it brain jogging. People need to remain intellectually alive, active, and to continue to challenge themselves. This includes everything from adult education classes in the Frome Institute, an elder hostel, to crossword puzzles and bridge clubs, to the development of new interests and the acquisition of new skills, and continuing to work. Parenthetically, head trauma must be avoided in people of all ages. I worry a lot about the kids that the coach sends back into the game after they have been knocked down and are woozy. Head trauma is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease in later years. Vision, hearing, and mobility are quintessential requirements for quality of life in the later years. Just ask Jean Calment, the French woman. Yet we don't test enough for glaucoma or caution people about the risk that excess sunlight poses to our eyes, not to mention the potential of melanoma. And we haven't addressed noise pollution or been sufficiently cautious about medications that can adversely affect hearing. What I'm saying is that we have to move beyond conventional efforts in health promotion and disease prevention, and to recognize how vitally important it is to be protective of the mind, of the vision, of hearing. Despite the high-profile marketing of so-called anti-aging medicine, there is no good evidence to support their claims. The human growth hormone, melatonin, DHEA, and testosterone are under-tested and potentially harmful. Under very special circumstances, testosterone is useful. Even estrogen replacement, which has been available for 50 years, has to be used with thoughtful evaluation. We have already made tremendous adjustments to late life in the 20th century. Both government and private sector have played and play a vital role. The financial services industry has grown by leaps and bounds. 30 years ago, who had ever heard of mutual funds and 401ks? Today, they have helped the stock market soar. Business opportunities are enormous. They are called the silver industries in Japan, and they include, of course, financial services, healthcare, pharmaceuticals, living arrangements, and travel. As we move into the next century, we simply cannot expect to have 69 million baby boomers starting in 2011 with all that talent and all that experience sit about idly collecting Social Security and utilizing Medicare. Having lived longer, people are simply going to have to work longer. When I was director of the National Institute on Aging, I was asked to testify before Alan Greenspan when he chaired President Reagan's National Commission on Social Security Reform. Since people live much longer, since Social Security was passed, shouldn't they work longer? Alan Greenspan asked. Keep in mind that the average life expectancy for men in 1935 was 59 and for women 63. My reply was a qualified yes. In some ways, retirement has been a 20th century aberration. It was required when the majority of people labored in mines and factories and foundries and on the farm. And it continues to be humane and necessary for individuals who have reasons to stop working after a lifetime of drudgery. But retirement must be marked now by a new kind of responsible aging. Through paid and unpaid work, people must continue to contribute to society. Since older workers are more expensive, also employers can be offered financial incentives, which is what happens in Japan. In my capacity as head of a U.S. government agency, namely the National Institute on Aging, as well as a private citizen, I have traveled to over 50 countries. In discussions with key persons in many nations, several concerns regarding the revolution in longevity have consistently emerged. They include the fear that societies will not be able to afford the growing numbers of older persons, that economic stagnation will result, and that intergenerational conflicts will be inevitable. At this time, I find no evidence to validate these concerns. Countries like Sweden, France, and Germany, with much higher percentages of older persons, have certainly not crashed. Insofar as economic downturns are concerned, it is clear that the dips and curves in the business cycle have not been attributable to population aging. Finally, polls taken in a number of nations, including the United States and France, do not demonstrate intergenerational conflict. Young people are quite positive about wanting to be certain that older persons of society are protected. I would like to draw your attention to the frequent references that are made to the dependency ratio. That is, the rising numbers of older persons compared to the generations of persons employed in the traditional workforce. It is suggested that with a growing older population, the workforce must shoulder an unfair burden in paying for their care. However, the total ratio indicates not only the increase in numbers of older persons, but the striking decline in birth rates. With the exception of Ireland and Turkey, most of the developed nations of the world are experiencing such a decline. It is almost as though nature has willed that with the extension of life, fewer new lives are required. A kind of balance is sought. In any case, if we look at the total dependency ratio, that is, if we add everyone under 18 and everyone over 65, and divide this number by the number of people in the traditional workforce, we come up with the fact that we have the same dependency ratio in 2050 as we had in 1900. Moreover, while it is nearly universal in the United States that children under 18 are not significant wage earners, a significant number of people over 65 are economically able to take care of themselves. And while the cost of raising a child to 18 is conservatively estimated to be $200,000, the number rises, again conservatively, to $300,000 if the child goes to college. The average cost of a nursing home, on the other hand, is about $40,000 a year, with an average stay of 2 years. Most important, the numbers of the dependency ratio are less important than the productivity per capita in evaluating the economic health of a population. One simple example: at the turn of the century, 37% of the population was engaged in agriculture. Today, that number is 2%, but we enjoy a plentiful food supply and overseas export. The longevity in this century has been extraordinary, accompanied by quality of life and societal maturity. Longevity has brought greater wealth to our world. Longevity is not a calamity, but it does require a set of realistic adjustments, some of which have already been made and some of which remain to be accomplished, so that we may fully celebrate this extraordinary human achievement. The bulk of my career as a physician has been devoted to medical research, teaching, and the care of patients. I have been motivated by concerns for individual older people, those suffering from dementia and other debilitating conditions, sentenced to ending their lives in nursing homes. But over the last decade, I have also become increasingly sensitive to the extraordinary impact of the unprecedented increase in the length of life and population aging upon older people and upon society as a whole, the family, the economy, the healthcare system. In short, I am devoted to the population-based public health approach. Of course, I retain my concern for the lives of older persons, but to enhance their quality of life, We must also confront a variety of issues. They range from the fair allocation of resources among the generations to the development of policy issues that guide medical science to bring Alzheimer's disease and other devastating conditions to an end, to the creation of necessary cultural, economic, and social roles for all of us at all ages. From these perspectives, the organization I now head, the International Longevity Center, was born. To meet the cultural and educational needs of older persons, that is to say, to assist in the search for purpose and meaning in late life, it is essential to change prevailing attitudes, language, and cultural attitudes that society maintains towards this last stage of life. We must dedicate ourselves to redefining old age and to transforming the views of older persons themselves toward the aging process. We must encourage artists, writers, scholars, and individuals working in the humanities, theater, cinema, and the media to explore new ways to communicate the experiences of older persons within the context of the human family. This is the first time in human history that the prospect of living a long, healthy, and productive life has become a reality for the majority of people in most parts of the world. What was the privilege of the few has become the destiny of the many. And it is likely that if this increase in longevity will continue into the next century, regenerative medicine will make possible the cultivation of replacement cells and tissues for diseased organs. Gene-based medicine will utilize the Human Genome Project to counter both genetic diseases and other diseases in which genes, through their protein products, play a pathogenic role. Why is there pessimism in some quarters? Words like calamity are heard. We have already seen remarkable adaptations to longevity in this century. Much more can be achieved. We must find ways that older people can continue to contribute to their families and to society as a whole. Life can be a work of art. As important as liberation by health, as powerful as liberation by law, old people must be liberated too from stereotypes that limit our and their horizons. We are in the midst of a wonderful new world of longevity. It is in our power to make it a celebration. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Robert Butler, President and CEO of International Longevity Center, USA, and author of Why Survive Being Old in America. At this time, Gene Herson, past president of the Commonwealth Club, will conduct our question and answer session.
Thank you, Ed Stolman. Dr. Butler, we have a large number of questions today submitted to the audience, so let's get going. First question. We have a personal friend who is going to be celebrating her 100th birthday this year. She attributes it to outlook. She thinks and acts like a 20-year-old. Do you agree?
I'm sorry, the last
she
part?
She thinks and acts like a 20-year-old.
Well, it is true that many people who reach later years still have tremendous elasticity, vitality, and interest in things that relate to the entire lifespan. But I bet she also thinks in terms of the later years, too, with the kind of experience, knowledge, that she's bound to have accumulated about people, about family life, and about our society.
This member asks, how has increased longevity changed the significant relationships that we have learned to enjoy between parents and grandparents, children and parents, and spouses?
Family life is tremendously changed. You know, we just barely getting used to the three-generation family because in the last century there's actually kind of a nostalgic and mistaken view, because if the average life expectancy was 47 in 1900, obviously many people didn't have grandparents. So we're just barely getting acquainted with what it means to have a three-generation family as we move now into the next century with four and five generations. It will change a great deal in the way of love, affection, working together, planning together, sharing experiences together.
This member must have seen Pokemon this week because he asked, will the gap of understanding between generations increase with increased longevity? The gap of understanding.
Well, in the what sort of strikes me is back in 1968 when the me generation, the baby boomers, announced that they couldn't trust anybody over 30. They're the ones who are now over 30, the oldest of whom is 54. And by 2011, they will cross into Golden Pond and will have to confront the fact that that gap has been disadvantageous. And many of them are beginning to experience problems and challenges with their parents and grandparents. So many of them are awakening to the realities of growing older in ways that I'm finding to be quite constructive, and they're becoming quite interested in the departments of geriatrics and why we don't have them, and in our International Longevity Center.
This male member asks, why do women live longer?
It's fascinating that at birth there are more baby boys than baby girls. But by 13, there are already more girls than boys. Boys do not seem to have the immune strength that girls do. They're more apt to die from infections. They also engage in much greater array of high-risk behavior, jumping out of second-floor windows or whatever. And throughout life, we see this. And there is probably two-thirds of the difference in life expectancy is probably attributable to greater amount of alcoholism and tobacco intake. And one-third is probably related to basic genetic differences, the hormonal system, the immune system. For example, the immune system may be different in women to in part account for their ability to carry a foreign object, namely a baby, for 9 months without rejecting it. And also in the later years with the strength of the hormonal system, they don't get as much heart disease until after the menopause. Then they begin to catch up with men.
Noted medical specialist Leonard Hayflick projects 115 to 120 years as the outside edge of the human life. Do you agree?
I believe most gerontologists around the world believe that the lifespan, which is the genetically determined species length, is about 110 to 120 in human beings. There are annual fish that live a year. There are mayflies that live a couple of days. There are these genetically determined lengths of life. That's to be distinguished from life expectancy, which is a life insurance term, in effect, namely how many years of life on average do you have left from birth, from 10, from 65, whatever. Yes, I think that's a general belief of gerontologists that it's somewhere in that range. And Jean Calmet, that I mentioned, is illustrative, having survived to 122.
How much of this increase in longevity has been the result of our style of life and our affluence versus the scientific developments and medical accomplishments that have been made over the last 50 years?
There's no question but much of the change and the increase in life expectancy has been related to public health, to sanitation, to vaccines, to a variety of efforts to create a more economically viable society. It really was the case that in the occasion of the French Revolution, from the studies by Nobel economist Robert Fogel, has shown that maybe a third of the French people did not even have enough food prior to the French Revolution to move about. I mean, they just barely had maintenance intake of calories. So certainly more calories is part of it. Now, of course, in this century, we began to have extensions based upon medical research itself. Sulfonamides in the 1930s, penicillin becoming available during the war, the advent of extraordinary surgical interventions, and, of course, now with the promise of a variety of new pharmaceutical agents.
There's a number of questions that center around longevity of the human species and our survivability in terms of overpopulation, environmental control, ozone, those issues. How do you relate those two?
Well, there is no question but what there are threats to longevity. We should not be complacent and assume that this gain will necessarily be maintained. The former Soviet Union, at the time of dissolution, had a distinct loss in life expectancy. A recrudescence of cholera, of diphtheria, of measles. Also, as a part of the demoralization, increased alcoholism, along with their continuing heavy smoking, not only in Russia, but it occurred in Hungary and in other of the countries that were part of the Soviet bloc. There are other threats as well. Within any 36 hours now, a pathogen can move from any other part of the world to any other part of the world. In New York City this summer, there was a good deal of unease because of the wild Nile virus, which was found and led to fatalities of a number of people. How did that virus get there? It must have gotten there probably by some trip on some ship in the air. So there are definite threats to longevity. Global warming could do this because global warming would lead to the recrudescence of malaria and of tropical diseases because the climates, by getting warmer, this would happen. The ozone hole, if it's destructive to the plankton, which are part of the base of the food chain, could lead to tremendous reverberations in terms of health. So we can't take longevity for granted. It really is very much dependent on our sense, good sense, because also we're engaged in a kind of a co-evolutionary relationship with a whole range of bugs. I know, and you know, that the misuse and overuse of antibiotics has helped contribute to the development of antibiotic-resistant tubercular bacillus and to other bacteria as well.
Along those lines, does weather play a role in terms of one's longevity? This reader points out that he believes that people in colder weather tend to survive longer.
There's no evidence, I'm afraid, that people in cold weather survive longer. In fact, in Great Britain, one of the classic studies some 20, 30 years ago was called Old and Cold. They don't have central heating in Great Britain. And accidental hypothermia occurs, where the core body temperature becomes too low to sustain life. Now, maybe you're thinking of the fact that Minnesota is among the long-living people, but Hawaii is number one, which is a very warm climate. But it may not have anything to do with the climate. It may have more to do with the Japanese ancestry within Hawaii. As you may know, Japan is the most rapidly aging nation in the world and has the longest living people. Minnesota, on the other hand, which is number two, does very well, perhaps because of the Swedish, Norwegian background. So it may not be so much a function of geography as it is a function of ethnicity, lifestyle, food habits, nutrition, high fish diet, a lot of vegetables.
There is a series of questions on the political ramifications of longevity, and the first one is, as we head into the presidential election, are any of the candidates addressing this issue?
20 organizations of very different backgrounds, not of any particular side of any political individual or political aisle, have joined together in sponsoring former Senator David Duerenberger of Minnesota again, to take leadership in trying to put long-term care on the campaign table, first in Iowa and then in New Hampshire. I don't know how successful that will be. For many of you, you should know long-term care is an incredibly expensive business. In New York State, it costs $100,000 a year. On average, in the United States, about $40,000 a year. And it's we don't also have the kind of well-trained people that we would wish to have. And we haven't developed adequately enough community-based care to make it possible for those who wish to remain at home through a variety of services such as care coordination, individual case management, and the like. So there's a definite potentially hot political issue there. But so far I haven't heard any of the seemingly major candidates address it.
In that light, should the retirement age for Social Security be advanced by a couple of years?
Well, only 18% of American adults know that Social Security's full eligibility age has been advanced. Only 16%. It's now 67, not 65. It's being phased in slowly, and it won't be totally in phase until 2027. And in policy circles in Washington, they are certainly talking about moving it up to 70 or perhaps putting it into a kind of algorithmic relationship as life expectancy increases, that there would be an increase in full eligibility. There's also discussion of not having Social Security kick in at 62, which it can today, at a lower payout than is true if you stay until 70 or 72 years of age. But I think that's likely to happen because as people living longer, I think it's just realistic to imagine we're going to have people working longer, contributing longer.
What do you make of the characterization of the World War II generation that it was the greatest generation?
Well, modestly, having been part of that, I would say that's a pretty good characterization. I think all generations are great. They all have their contribution to make, and they will, each in their own way. They have to always, of course, grow into a kind of maturation phase where they accept responsibilities after having scanned what the responsibilities might be. I think it was a wonderful generation also because not only that they experienced World War II, but the Great Depression. And I think that they have a sense of what is valuable, which perhaps some younger people, not having had that painful experience, may not quite know what it really means to have to struggle. I mean, 25% of adult Americans were unemployed in the 1930s, one out of four. That was profound.
Dr. Dean Adele, the radio doc, has written a book, Eat, Drink, and Be Merry. Do you agree?
I believe in the merry part. I think you have to eat, of course. And the data, for example, one of the best studies out of Harvard shows that if you do not drink any alcohol at all, that's not good. But if you drink more than four or five a week, that's not good either. So I think we go right back to Mr. Aristotle. There's something to be said for moderation, for good sense. And I think that that's probably the needed answer to those who say just eat, drink, and be merry without giving it much thought.
With the advancement of plastic surgery and cosmetic replacement of all our parts, should we try to look as good as we feel, or is this a search of a perpetual youth equivalent to Jason's search for the golden fleece?
Well, my friend Ed Stallman and I have decided to keep our white hair. We're not going to let that change. I think that if you're in business, if you're in the theater, if you're in the movies, if your job depends upon appearance, I don't think one should be condemning of those who may search out cosmetic surgery. On the other hand, a lot of it, of course, is a search for vanity and a vain search because it won't ultimately work. So I think we do better to build our own character strength than to build our own personalities and not be quite that attentive to external appearances.
This member asks, my greatest fear in aging is memory loss. Although it may be advantageous for my marriage, can you recommend anything I can do?
Memory loss really is, of course, a serious problem. And when I had the opportunity to start the National Institute on Aging, I personally looked at what the totality of the National Institutes of Health and the National Institute of Mental Health was doing in the way of studying any aspect of brain aging. And I have to tell you, there were only 12 grants. This is 1975. And they averaged about $60,000 per grant. A little over $700,000. And yet, you know, half of the people in nursing homes were suffering from Alzheimer's disease. Many of the people in the back wards of state hospitals were suffering from Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. That's why I made it a personal campaign on my part to try to make it a national priority, research priority, and to try to make it a household word. I turned to a public relations person who gave me wrong advice, said change the name of the disease, but we decided not to do that. But we got Hugh Downs and Princess Yasmin Aga Khan, the daughter of Rita Hayworth, and others mobilized, and I think it's worth noting that there's now about $400 million being devoted to trying to understand Alzheimer's disease. We've made a lot of progress. We're not there yet, but we've made a lot of progress. Now, I do think a lot of people worry unnecessarily about memory because there are some data that show that after you've lived a certain amount of time, there's a lot of information that gets accumulated. And some of the problem is not so much memory as it is more time in retrieving out of a whole array of information. Having a teenager, I can also tell you, there are things that might be called junior moments as well as senior moments.
You mentioned the remarkable trip of John Glenn. What different conditions existed for John Glenn as he prepared for space?
Well, he always kept himself in terrific condition, so he was in very good health. And, you know, it could be that in January we'll be noting that we sent a 40-year-old up into outer space instead of a 78-year-old. He's in great shape. But quite seriously, we are hopeful that we can learn some things about protein turnover, about balance, as balance differs as we grow older, about a variety of other chemical measurements, and we'll see. But he was in very good condition, and he, you know, walked off that plane, and something like 20% of astronauts, younger astronauts, are not able to walk off the ship. He wobbled a little bit, but as I say, some of them couldn't come out on their feet at all, not on that particular trip. So he really did very, very well.
I recently retired at the age of 57, and the greatest difference I feel is stress, namely the reduction of stress. Please comment on stress as a major force in longevity.
I do believe that stress has been underestimated. We live in such a faster society. We live with so much noise and so much going on around us. The ability to relax has become compromised, I think, for many. In our overheated economy and with all of our ambitions and all of our efforts. So I do think stress is a very important part. Bruce McEwen, who's an outstanding scientist at Rockefeller University and a member of the National Academy of Science, and Bert Singer, who's a professor of demography and public affairs at Princeton, and Carol Riff, who's a professor of psychology at University of Wisconsin-Madison, have been working together looking at issues related to stress and purpose in life. Because having some central purpose in life really does seem to be extremely important to longevity. When we did our studies at NIH that I referred to earlier back in the 50s and 60s, one of the things that knocked me out personally was the extent to which having goals in life and structure to your everyday life was very much related to longevity and the quality of life. If you can sustain that purpose in the wake of all of the multiplicity of intense stimuli in modern culture, I think that's quite an accomplishment.
What other countries have longevity compared to the United States? How do we rank, and what are they doing different?
I'm sorry to say that we don't do so well. We're number 10 in terms of length of life for women. We're number 18 in terms of length of life for men. Now, some of this is because we do not have a homogeneous society. We have a very heterogeneous society, richly pluralistic, wonderfully multi-ethnic and multicultural. And as you know, as new waves of people have come to our shores, they've often had greater problems, economic problems, until they've had a chance to work their way up the ladder. So that we do have great disparities in health and education and life expectancy, which would not be the case, say, in Sweden or Japan, just to give two examples, both of which countries have people living much longer than we do. But if you look at those in higher socioeconomic status, of course, we do very well. And there was a major symposium at the National Institutes of Health last spring that showed an extraordinary sensitivity between educational level, socioeconomic status, and longevity. Just a little bit can make a tremendous difference.
At what age does diet, vitamins, and the famous baby aspirin become significant?
Well, it's really best, of course, to eat sensibly all of your life. It's sad to know that 20% of America's children are now overweight, that Type 2 diabetes, which is late-life diabetes, is now found among America's children. that only one state has mandatory physical education, that Atlanta has abandoned recess. We really do have a serious problem in terms of the physical education of kids. And that certainly bears upon the topic. We don't have good food for the kids in our schools. We have a fast food diet. And I emphasize all that because we wouldn't have to take those vitamins at all if we really were eating the 5 to 7 fruits and vegetables every day that we should eat, the servings, that is. But since we don't do that, we probably should recommend the least expensive multivitamin for everybody throughout life. The baby aspirin is probably not an issue until maybe one's late 40s and 50s, but we do have to remember that 1/3 of all strokes occur under 65 years of age. So you can't wait to 65 to start taking the baby aspirin.
This member asks, given your shopping list of social changes necessary to sustain our aging population, what would be your recommendation to Congress for the number one action item?
Well, I do think we should have a national task force or commission that addresses this incredible demographic revolution. It's unbelievable. I mean, it's nothing like this has ever happened in human history. And the manifestations are so pervasive that it really can't be handled just idly. I think we also need, as we did have briefly during the Carter administration, a presidential counselor on aging who can then integrate across all the departments. Transportation is affected. Health is affected. Every agency of government, really. Housing, for example. So I think we do need to do some cross-cutting efforts to bring government to bear. But I would do it as a private-public joint partnership, as a joint initiative. I've had debates with my friend Pete Peterson, who's written a gloomy book called The Gray Dawn, in which he would think the whole world will fall apart because of this growing number of older people. And someone said, and he himself has said, that it's a book, if you put it down, you don't want to pick it back up. But I think that we have to challenge our corporate sector to find ways to maintain the continuing contributions of older people. Now, if this were 1900 and we were having this discussion, someone might say, how can we afford all these growing numbers of 50-year-olds and 55-year-olds? And what are we going to do with all this? But we've simply put forward in time diseases, disability. We've simply extended life, and by that, to that degree, in due proportion, society's going to have to change. And I don't think it should be just government alone, but a joint effort of the private and public sector. That's part of the mission of the International Longevity Center, is to recognize that we can learn so much from other countries, and they can learn from us, and we can focus on two big priorities: how to promote a productive work life in society, and how to promote healthy, active life expectancy.
We have reached a point in our program where there's just time for one more question. And that question is, men tend to age, women tend to get more attractive. Can you explain?
I certainly agree with that.
Our thanks today to Dr. Robert Butler, President and CEO of International Longevity Center, USA, and author of Why Survive, Being Old in America, for joining us today. We also thank our audience here in San Francisco, as well as our listeners on our radio. Now, this meeting of the Commonwealth Club, the nation's oldest and largest public forum, is adjourned. Thank you.